The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We talk about those things that are going on in the world, and we look at them through the prism of our Catholic values, our Catholic beliefs, because ever since the time of Jesus and before that, Jesus kind of came into our world to move our world more in the direction of his kingdom and the values of those kingdom. And so he kind of told us a good thing, a bad thing. Bad thing is he wasn't going to keep us safe from all of the problems of this world. He wasn't going to take us immediately to heaven where we could escape it all. The good thing, he told us he would be with us. And he told us that there are ways that we can make our world to be a little bit more heaven-like. Now, I know some days I'm not sure we're moving too much in the heaven-like direction, but that's our challenge, and that is our goal, to kind of make our world a little bit more just, a little bit more compassionate, because justice, compassion, caring, love, peace, they are all right at the center of the kingdom of heaven. And that's why, you know, we want to be there one day, because it's good, the tears will be wiped away. But while we're on the journey, we got some work to do, and that's what we try to do here on Just Love, is we talk about those issues which are part of the world in which we, Catholics, Christians, all of us live in, and the prism that we bring to it is we got a job to do to make that more just and make that more compassionate. You know, a lot of what is focused around these days is how is that done through politics, not so much politics, but how is it done through our established government institutions? And what politics is often about, and particularly this side of the year, politics is kind of the process by which we decide who's going to lead those institutions. I mean, sometimes we get a little bit kind of mixed up, or we get a little bit confused, a little bit opaque by all of the hoopla and noise. But basically, politics is kind of trying to figure out how we live in this world together, how we make compromises when we have differences of opinion, how we deal with the imperfections in the world when we're not going to make it all perfect, but how are we going to move it in the direction of being better? And how do we make it in the world better, not just for me, and maybe not just for me and my family, not maybe just me and my neighbors, but for everybody in our neighborhood, everybody in our towns, in our states, in our country. And then for those of us who are Catholics, we have a real difficulty, because we believe that the good that we try to achieve is not limited to our own country, even though there is a natural sense of pride, a sense of good sense of patriotism that's here. But the reality is we believe that every person is made in the image and likeness of God. And so when we talk about the common good, we include the common good of people who we've never seen, countries we've never been to, because believing that they're all made in God's image and likeness, when we design our policies and the way we think about things, we also have to keep them in mind. And, you know, I will mention that since we're in this political season in which we're trying to, when we are determining who will be the next president of the United States, sometimes when we raise that issue, it doesn't make it into a lot of conversation, into platforms, because, you know, presidents of the United States, you know, they have as their job to look out what's in the best interest of the United States. It's not their job to kind of put first and foremost what's in the best interest of other countries. Now, you know, I think there's a sophisticated analysis which basically says, and I think people can understand it, is that, you know, many, many times if something is in the best interest of other countries, it's in our best interest. Maybe not always, but I think we can make a point that if we look to create a world in which as many rights are respected everywhere, in which there's as much economic security everywhere, I think you could make a pretty decent case that that creates a better situation for our own country. And so I think that's kind of one of the things we kind of look about. So listen, we have wonderful guests here today on our show. And so let's go to our first guest. First guest is Professor Jamie Longazel, who is an assistant professor of sociology, a research fellow at the Human Rights Center of the University of Dayton in Ohio. Professor Longazel, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Thank you so much for having me, Monsignor.
Great. Hey, you're one of those smart guys. You've written a few books, huh?
I have, yes.
Okay, so listen, in this presidential year, we really have raised up the issue of immigration. We've raised up that issue, and we've raised up the issue of policing, arrests, a crime, safety, those type of things. And it just so happens that you've written two books. One of them is on immigration and the politics of divide, and the other is the pains of mass incarceration. So I'm just delighted that we're going to be able to speak with you about topics which kind of really have made it to the top of kind of our presidential season this year. So, Professor Longazel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks
again. All right. So let's begin with I think is the easier topic, but let's begin with the one of immigration, those issues. And you particularly looked at a particular situation in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, did you not?
That's correct. Hazleton, Pennsylvania is, in fact, my hometown. It's where I grew up, and it was a city that garnered national attention back in 2006 when it passed the highly controversial ordinance known as the Illegal Immigration Relief Act that was designed to punish landlords for renting to undocumented immigrants, punish businesses for hiring undocumented folks, and for and to make English the city's official language.
Wow. That was pretty kind of straightforward stuff in terms of kind of not being too welcoming of immigrants, I would say. I think that is. Isn't that the case?
I think it's pretty undisputable that this was an exclusionary ordinance. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And, I do have to ask you a parenthetical question, given what's happened in the past week. How far is Hazleton, Pennsylvania from Latrobe, Pennsylvania?
So Hazleton is in the northeastern part of the city. It's about an hour and a half north of Philadelphia and okay. About 2 hours to the west of New York City.
So it's kind of up in the Poconos region, kind of the New York, New Jersey, that kind of area of Pennsylvania?
That's right. It sits at the intersection of Interstates 80 and 81.
Okay. So it's up in that neck of the woods. So, I mean, that doesn't seem to me to be a particularly hotbed area of immigration stuff. What was going on there that gave rise to such a really harsh piece of legislation?
Absolutely. You wouldn't expect it to be the epicenter for the immigration debate as it was for a short time in 2006 when the national news was all over this case and talking about it. What happened was the city, like so many other cities along the Rust Belt in that area, has been experiencing demanufacturing. Hazleton is a former coal mining town that was really struggling after coal sunk in the 1950s, and it resorted to manufacturing and managed to keep its head above water in the decades that followed with these manufacturing jobs that recently have been leaving quite rapidly. And so what's happened in the last 15 or 20 years is that in response to demanufacturing, developers have been attracting other types of industry, namely warehouses, distribution centers, and most importantly, a meatpacking plant, industry that tends to be lower paying, more exploitative, I would say, offers jobs that are more temporary, less permanent, less opportunities for upward mobility, that sort of thing. And it was those jobs that prompted a pretty rapid and pretty large demographic shift beginning just a few years before that ordinance was passed.
And so tell us what happened when they passed it.
Yeah, sure. So to give you a sense of the size of the shift, so in the 2000 census, Hazleton's population was 95% white. By 2006, when the ordinance was passed, estimates said that the city was about 36% Latino, and it's closer to 50% today. The immigrants are the largest population is from the Dominican Republic, and in many cases, these are folks who initially settled in either New York or New Jersey and saw Hazleton as this opportunity in the sense that it had jobs. It had a much lower cost of living than New York City. It was a quiet place with which where someone could raise a family, that sort of thing. And, you know, the change happened. And what I talk about in the book is how the native-born residents of the city who you know, are the folks I grew up around, are understandably so economically anxious. You know, it's a real it's a time of uncertainty where when these jobs are leaving and you know, one can't trust that they'll be able to work into walk into a factory and get a job that's going to last them a long time and allow them to live a comfortable life. And so there's this economic uncertainty and anxiety that I think has been exploited. And in such a way that uncertainty and the decline of the city economically, the increasing impoverishment that we're seeing in the city, has been blamed not on demanufacturing or not on the massive tax incentives that some of these new companies are getting if they arrive in this place, but rather on immigrants. And so the narrative around the ordinance was that undocumented immigrants are coming in and committing more crime and draining the city's resources. And these things weren't true, but they resonated because people were craving.
You don't sound old enough to be so old-fashioned and to think you want to introduce some facts or truth into our policy debates. Don't tell me that.
Imagine that.
Well,
relying on truth. Yes.
Hey, listeners, Professor Jamie Long Giselle is the professor of sociology at the University of Dayton, and he believes in facts and truth. I don't know. You may not go far in your career in that, but anyway, I'm sorry for kidding you. But anyway, so they passed the law now. They passed the law, and they got the law on the books. Is it still on the books?
No, it was immediately challenged in court. And it was, after a long appeals process, ruled unconstitutional. And so it never was enforced. But I don't know it would have been nightmarish for many people if it was enforced, to be sure. But I would say it didn't necessarily matter in the sense that it still had an effect. It really sent a powerful message about who's a part of this community. How this community is going to identify itself at this moment, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, the ordinance, although never enforced, really the cloud that it left is still kind of hanging over the city in significant ways.
You know, one of the things that is of so kind of interests me, and I think it's part of, you know, you use the words politics of divide. There's kind of the reality of divide that I see. I mean, I live in New York City, and the reality is, I mean, New York City is not perfect, even though sometimes I talk about it that way. But New York City is not perfect. But we couldn't live. I mean, we are an immigrant city. We are a city. I mean, you know, I get up early. I walk. I mean, the jobs that are being done. I mean, as I walk to work many days, the jobs that are being done, ordinary jobs that people are doing, whether they be opening a store in the morning, the coffee shop, or whatever they are. Maybe they're delivering breakfast someplace, or they're unloading a truck. Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not into the profiling, but I am into observing. Those jobs are being done by immigrants. And immigrants, they may not be first generation, but they're at least second, or they might be immigrants themselves. And so it's really, we kind of have this divide in the country in which, in some places, it is an immigrant place. In other places, immigrants are considered as foreign, you know, outcasts. That's what the divide, I think, is so harmful that we have in the country today.
I think that's right. I think there are, you know, Hazleton was significant in 2006 because it wasn't the first locale or state to do this, but it was the first of this sort of stage of it. And after Hazleton passed its law, many other cities started passing similar laws. Some were even using this same language of this ordinance. We started to see states such as Arizona pass these exclusionary measures. And at the same time, there have been many other places, including Dayton, Ohio, where I live now, that passed resolutions declaring themselves to be immigrant friendly, you know? And so yes, there's absolutely very different ways to approach this. There are alternatives out there. And as a case like Dayton, I think, shows, Dayton's the city that's also experiencing demanufacturing that sits along the Rust Belt. It shows that even in a difficult economic climate, we can send a welcoming message. We can identify our communities as inclusionary rather than exclusionary.
And I think that's one of the parts of this presidential election that for me is so disappointing. Listen, I, you know, for a long time, I've been worked with groups and things who believe we need comprehensive immigration reform. We think we need to secure the borders in a humane way. We believe that we need to find a way that there is just and humane legal immigration. We're not in favor of illegal immigration. And we have to find a way for those who currently don't have the right papers to earn the way to get the right papers. So I'm on that side of the debate. What is very discouraging to me is that you can't have a conversation about it. All you do is wind up shouting about it. And I think it's a legitimate debate as to how we reform the system. It's not an illegitimate debate to just shout and scream and say no, that when you it's not legitimate to say a path to legalization is amnesty. It's not a legitimate thing, maybe even on the other side, to say any attempt to secure the border is unjust and harsh. But that's where we are in the country today. You got any solutions to getting us out of that great divide?
You know, I think one of the things that I like to do is to talk about this as something different, not as something that it's not, but something that it is, but that we don't really see. And so what I mean by that is, what's happening is an economic story, right? And so in Hazleton, for example, you have immigrants who are arriving there that have been uprooted, essentially, by these bigger global economic processes, by the implications of things like NAFTA and other trade deals. And so you have that group, and then you have the native-born, mostly white residents who have been, you know, struggling as a result of demanufacturing and these sorts of trends. And so you have two populations that are essentially experiencing this same phenomenon, right? And so for me, the question becomes, how do we work with that? You know, how can we have this conversation about who gets what in our society and how many of us, how such a large number of us have so little and such a small number of us have so much. You know, to me, that's the kind of question that really has the potential to sort of bridge these divides. You know, we can recognize that our suffering and someone else's suffering who is much different from us has similarities to it, right? It comes from very similar roots.
So let me just tell you, here's my hypothesis, which I'd be willing to put a few bucks on in the whole Hazleton thing. As soon as you mentioned to me that a lot of the Hispanics were from the Dominican Republic, I guarantee you that was not their first stop. I guarantee you that they stopped first in Washington Heights, and a few of them bought some timeshares out in the Poconos and began going there on weekends. And then you gradually, maybe there's some jobs and stuff like that there. That's my hypothesis. And if that's true, it's exactly what the Irish did in Washington Heights a generation or two ago. But they didn't go to Hazleton. They went up to Rockland County and Orange County and places like that. So, I mean, I could be entirely wrong, but I'm betting that's my hypothesis. And it's what every immigrant group tends to do.
Yeah, you know, that is a hypothesis that is correct. And it's amazing to me. What's really fascinated me through this entire process is how this happened again. You know, I mean, yes, it's interesting that this place that's so far from the U.S.-Mexico border is at the epicenter of the immigration debate. But what's more fascinating is that this place that used to rely on this brutal exploitation of European immigrant groups who were routinely pitted against one another. The English and the Welsh were here first, and then when the Irish came, and then when the Italians came, they were labeled as subhuman. They were put at the bottom of the social and employment hierarchy. They were told by the coal barons that, the higher up groups were told by the coal barons that all of their problems were being caused by the Irish. And you know, it's exactly what we see today, except instead of coal mines, it's different industries, but it's the same exact phenomenon. And so the fact that we're capable of forgetting that and not, applying those lessons of the past to the future is quite disturbing in my mind.
Hey, Professor Longe-Giselle, thank you so much for being with us. Do you got another few minutes? Because I would like to talk about the mass incarceration issue. If you have another 5 minutes or so, can we?
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
Absolutely.
So tell us about that. And my little take on life, mass incarceration, I think if I look at the statistics, but I'm going to let you talk about it, does have some racial correlations. And it's got some relationship to some of the community kind of policing issues and policing things that have risen to the surface. So talk to me a little bit about your take on the whole mass incarceration issue and something that I think we're even getting a little bipartisan movement on this issue. So give us your take on this.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's actually not that much of a shift from the conversation about immigration, because what happened in the U.S. is following the civil rights movement, and many have made a convincing case that in response to the gains made in the civil rights movement, we started to declare ourselves, you know, led by politicians who were doing this, started to declare ourselves tough on crime, and you know, the sort of insistence that we would be tough no matter what, and politicians were trying to outdo one another in terms of toughness, and they were doing this in a very racially coded way. You know, there were these messages being sent that we were going to, you know, crack down on inner city crime or something like that, not unlike the messages like we're going to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, is this kind of messaging that led to a criminal justice apparatus that was going to incarcerate more and more people, that was going to lock people up for nonviolent drug offenses, that was going to do things like have mandatory minimum sentences where if you get convicted of a third felony, even if it's something minor, you would face life in prison. All of these sorts of things happened from, you know, late 60s, early 70s, really accelerating into the 80s and carrying forward into the present, such that our imprisonment rate today is higher than any other country in the world. What we talk about in the book, The Pains of Mass Imprisonment, is some of the human rights violations that are taking place behind bars in prisons today, which often are outside of the public's view, and something that's really hard even for journalists to report on. You're right. There is some bipartisan agreement that we need to fix this. I think both sides come at it from different angles or see different reasons for why we need to fix it. I think one side is, kind of speaking the language of injustice and seeing this as not separate from phenomenon like police shootings and implicit bias and those sorts of things. And so it's a justice issue to solve this problem that has devastated not just the people behind bars, but their families and their communities. The other side is sort of saying, gosh, this costs a lot of money. You know, I don't think we can afford to do this in the long term. And so, you know, because the interests aligned in that way, I think we're starting to see a bit of a shift, but we've got a long, long way to go.
Well, and then if you're dealing about the prison system more than the jail system, this is an economic interest for communities in different parts of the country. It's a little bit about military base closings. It's not about is not only about is this base necessary for the defense of the country? Is this prison necessary for incarcerating people who have broken the law and been convicted? What's it do about my job?
Right. So you know, now that we have 2.3 million people approximately in prisons and jails today, the question is, how do we reduce that number? I mean, number one, it would require the political courage to you know, do things like reduce sentences or something along those lines. That even though the climate has changed, I still don't see a lot of politicians really stepping up to be willing to do. And then in addition to that, they would need to be answering to, yes, as you say, those people who have their jobs in these prisons that have, you know, we built and built and built and built over the last several decades. And you know, there's this sort of natural inclination to want to use a structure that we erect. And so it becomes this question of, yeah, how do we actually undo this thing?
Yeah, it is. It's a real, real challenge. And, you know, with probably most reform that actually gets to happen, you kind of do a lot of things incrementally. If there were one thing at the current time that you think our listeners should kind of pay attention to as a possible area in which at least some progress could be made, what would you kind of tell our listeners pay attention to? Because this might be something that might get some traction, or our listeners might say, hey, I like that idea. Let me help to get some traction on this issue.
You know, I think it's important to realize that, especially with an issue like imprisonment, and even with an issue like immigration, there's a lot that's going on that sort of slides under the radar. You know, we don't often get to hear stories about the dangers of someone actually attempting to walk across the border. We don't often hear the stories about the conditions that people in prison confront. For instance, we haven't heard a lot of coverage, although there's been some, about the one of the largest strikes in prison history that's going on right now, where many incarcerated people are refusing to work for little or no pay. And, you know, these sorts of things are happening, and they're the realities of people's lives. And so it becomes easy, I think, especially in a political climate like this one, as you said, to get into these shouting matches that oftentimes just sort of create these abstractions, right? They turn the issue into things like legal, illegal, did you do the crime or not? And they miss all of the complexities of the human beings that are experiencing these conditions. They have a tendency, I think, to really take away our ability to have empathy, to be compassionate. You know, when we don't see people as people, we can really easily, you know, dismiss them as being something else, as criminals or illegal or something along those lines. But it's these human narratives, these human stories that really capture the reality that I think we ought to be paying attention to and try to make our policy choices based on that.
Hey, Professor Jamie Longazel, thanks so much for spending so much time with us. And hey, and thanks for the book on Hazleton, and thanks for your work on mass incarceration. It really kind of helps to inform our debate, and as we say here, to try to make our world a little bit more just and a little bit more compassionate. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love today.
Thank you.
Professor Jamie Longazel, Professor of Sociology at the University of Dayton in Ohio. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back on Just Love. Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, this is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just. It will be more compassionate. You know, we're in the middle of the presidential election season in the United States, and a lot of things going on, and a lot of issues being raised up. And sometimes we kind of think about the issues in the United States only from the perspective of the United States. Obviously, we have to think about them from the perspective of our country. But if we don't think about them from the perspective of the rest of the world, then we're in trouble. And that's a little bit of a uniqueness that I think Catholics bring to discussion, policy in the public square, because we believe that we are, we believe that people throughout the world are made in God's image and likeness. And so we're kind of look a little bit beyond the borders of the United States, and we look at things from a worldwide perspective. Now, we did speak a little bit earlier in the show about the issue of immigration. And, you know, sometimes when we think about immigration, migrants, refugees, we all kind of get them together. And in some sense, the people who are on the move, even voluntarily or involuntarily. But I am delighted that our next guest, Sister Donna Markham, who is the president of Catholic Charities USA, which is the organization that is kind of the umbrella for all the local Catholic charities throughout the United States, of which the one that I work in New York is proud to be part of that organization, that federation. And so I'm delighted that Sister Donna Markham is with us, and she's a real big shot. So we're really happy that she is with us. She hangs out with all these important people at the United Nations, and she hangs out with people in Rome and popes and things like that. So I'm delighted, because one of the issues which we got to talk about is refugees and what's going on in the world. And so, Sister Donna Markham, thanks so much for being a guest today on Just Love.
I'm delighted to be with you, Monsignor Sullivan. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so tell us about the big shots at the UN, who you were able to speak with last week on some of the issues of immigration, refugees. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I was delighted to be part of a high-level side event at the UN that was really called for by the Council the Pontifical Council with Migration, Refugees, and Cardinal Parolin from the Vatican, as Secretary of State of the Vatican, was actually the main speaker there. And so it was really quite impressive to be able to hear the story coming from both Cardinal Parolin talking about the Pope's real emphasis on caring for migrants and refugees, and to the extent that Pope Francis himself is going to be overseeing this work of the Church. My role in the conference was to really talk a little bit about what's happening with refugees in this country, and it's surprising, I think, to many to know that last year alone there were approximately 70,000 refugees who came into the United States, people who came in as refugees, not willing. Willingly in terms of immigration, but people who had nowhere to go and landed on our borders.
And Donna, let me just, for our listeners out there, I've talked about this before, but my memory isn't too good, so maybe some of our listeners need a little refresher. So the difference between immigrants and refugees is the immigrants generally come to the United States voluntarily, although there's oftentimes economic pressure on them.
Sure.
Refugees are people who basically are found that there's such danger going on in the place where they've come from that they can't go back. And so they basically are considered people who need a new place to live because the persecution, the problems, the violence, the war, et cetera, is in their own country, so they can't go back. So just for our listeners, that's what Sister Donna is speaking about. So please, go on.
Yes. Well, and if you figure that we have 70,000 people who came to the U.S. last year alone, and out of that 70,000, Catholic Charities agencies settled about a third of those people. And that included helping unaccompanied minors who've come over the border from the south. It also meant helping people who have come to our country from Iraq and Syria, from Africa, from all over the world. And I think it's really important. I think the listeners, you know, your listeners may be interested in knowing that there's always been that sense that, oh, the refugees are coming in and the country is going to be responsible for having to foot the bill for taking care of them. And, we don't recognize the contribution they make to our country. So there was a study recently done with the Lab for Economic Opportunity at the University of Notre Dame in conjunction with Catholic Charities across the U.S. And they did a study to look at, you know, what is really happening? Are these folks contributing, or are we taking care of them? Are they successful or not? And the study found that children who come to the U.S. at the age of 12 or younger actually graduate from high school at rates that are above or comparable to U.S.-born children.
Hmm.
So that's the kids. And then if we look at, I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
Because they're working very hard to make it, and they're learning second language or third language. And then in addition to that, it was what happens to older people that are coming, say, between the ages of 21 and 40. And so the study looked at what was the long range impact? You know, are they, what happens with them 20 years down the road or 10 years down the road? Where are they? And the study found out that over the course of their process of getting resettled, they received about $100,000 in support, but returned $122,000 in taxes. So actually, they are profitable contributors to our state, local, and federal treasures of about $21,000. And that just says a lot.
We're speaking with Sister Donna Markham, who's the president of Catholic Charities USA. You know, Donna, let me give you a little bit of a sidetrack for a moment, because, you know, you talk about this lab for Center for Economic Opportunity and Notre Dame and research. I mean, I think some of our listeners, I mean, we think of Catholic Charities as, you know, we help people. If they're hungry, we give them a meal. If we, you know, we try to house them, we try to be nice to them, we do things like that. But this looks to me like Catholic Charities USA is involved in something which is maybe a little bit more rigorous, and maybe looking a little bit about, does what we do actually help people? Could you explain this lab for economic opportunities?
Yeah, I think it's really important that if we say absolutely we're committed to helping people that are in trouble of one sort or another by virtue of not having a place to go or any food to eat, and we provide services for them, are the things that we're doing actually, as you say, bringing people out of poverty? Is it making any difference? Because when we go to the Congress and we say we need funding for a project, we need to bring data that says we can say that what we're doing is working. And do you want to invest in this initiative that's really going to help people? So we need the hard data. And so we're partnering with the Lab for Economic Opportunity to really work with our Catholic Charities agencies to determine the effectiveness of the programs that our agencies are providing. And we're finding out some absolutely wonderful things about the effectiveness of the programs. And this refugee part is really shooting a hole in the argument that refugees are a drain on us.
Well, you know, Donna, I think that's a tremendous initiative. My sadness, however, is that, and you kind of engage in this far more than I do, but my sadness is that, you know, in our policy debates these days, nobody really wants to be bothered with the facts. They really love their own perspective and they love their own biases. So it's hard, even when you have the facts, you have to cut through it to get the facts before people.
Absolutely. And the election cycle is probably the worst time in our history. When
we're having an election in this country, are we?
So I hear.
Hey, you know, Donna, listen, I know the UN and as you mentioned, 70,000 or so refugees coming into the United States. you know, we've talked a lot on this show, but the fact that at the moment, I believe there's somewheres around 22, 23 million refugees worldwide, in addition to another 42 or 43,000 internally displaced persons.
42 million, yes.
Yeah, 42 million. So,
yeah, we've got 65 million people.
Yep. Which is a million more people than in Great Britain.
Yeah.
It's one of those. But you know what I'd like you, you know, if you, I know I can convince you to spend a moment or two about a situation that you've been very close to, the situation of displaced people and refugees in Iraq, because you've visited there. Share with our listeners a little bit of that experience.
Yes, I've been to Iraq twice and have been very close to the Christian community in Iraq, most of, well, all of whom have been in either internally displaced or forced to leave the country for fear of their lives. So that situation of people that have lived on a land and have lived, they would be living in a way that quite simply would be like a middle class or upper middle class way of life in their country, and overnight forced to abandon their home, everything they owned, run for their lives, and their homes and their churches were taken over by ISIS, and they are now living in camps and internally displaced refugee camps outside of in northern Iraq, in Erbil. But when you think about it in terms of ourselves, that this would be like us going home one night and getting a message, you have to get out of your house right now, get out of here before these people come to murder you. Run for your life. And I know that the sisters that I'm very close to piled into their van, they put the elders in the van and the younger ones walked behind, and they walked for 7 hours to flee their convent in near Mosul, Iraq, and they left with nothing. And one of them, fortunately, had the foresight to take her laptop computer with her, and that's the only way they communicated for months as they were on the run. So this is a tragic situation, and I find it personally horrifying when I hear people talk about these people are all terrorists and we can't let them get near our country and they're going to destroy us. And I've seen too much to realize that that's not the case. These are wonderful people.
And the reality, when you talk about 70,000 refugees coming into the country, most of those, it took them probably 18 months or two years in order to first, what people don't recognize, first to be kind of declared a refugee officially by the United Nations. And so, okay, there's some feeling in this country, it's the United Nations, they don't like America. Okay. But first, they go through that whole process by the United Nations, and then they go through a process by the United States government to making sure that that's fine. But again, we don't want to be convinced by the facts because...
No, we don't want to use facts.
Right. But the one thing I do think, you know, and Donna, thanks for taking the time, just another couple of minutes. What I find incredibly inspiring is that, and I'll use the word refugees short term, that the refugee sisters became the refugee advocates and helpers in the new place.
That's right. The sisters themselves left. They went into the camps. They felt when they were in the camps that they realized that there all these children and families were there. The kids' way of life had been disrupted. So what the sisters did was to set up kindergartens and schools within the camps and try to structure the children's lives so that they could have some normalcy. And then they set up some clinics, medical clinics, to help people with whatever limited resources they were able to get. But the sisters in their own state of being displaced are reaching out to the others, the thousands of others. that are their neighbors.
And in fact, for at least a year or so, some of the sisters actually lived in the same type of housing, those trailers, those caravans, yeah. those containers, next to the convent that yep. that the same type that was in the refugee camps. It was
That's right.
nothing different there. It was just a really painful thing. And, you know, again, we think about this country and, or as you say, you know, everybody's a terrorist, all of that type of stuff. Well, I bet in that refugee, in that camp in northern Iraq last spring, there were more kids who made their first communion there than in the majority of parishes in the United States.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of that. I think they had 200 little kids that made first communion in one of those camps.
Right, and I think maybe the year before, since it was first year, they may have had 400. So
That's
I mean,
right.
it's you know, I know there are many parishes that have 40, 50, 60, something like that. So it's a tragic story, but it's also a story of a little bit of inspiration. So,
and deep faith.
Yes,
I mean,
it
absolute
is.
Deep faith.
Hey, go back to work.
You got a job.
Hey, thank you for taking the time. Sister Donna Markham, the CEO and president of Catholic Charities USA, she shared some of her experience at the United Nations last week and some of her experience when she herself went to visit her fellow Dominican sisters in Iraq. We're going to take a break. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just love God, neighbor, self, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Tom, and kind of continuing our conversation of refugees, displaced persons, nobody really focuses on the fact that there are over 5 million internally displaced persons in Colombia, South America, based upon the drug wars, the violence that is there. So tell us just briefly a little bit of the good news about that.
Sure, Monsignor. Well, I mean, this past week, the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the group known as the FARC, entered into a peace agreement, bringing to an end what was the longest running war in the American hemisphere, 52 years. And as you had mentioned, that war and that struggle had left some 220,000 people killed and 5 million Colombians displaced.
How long was the war going on for?
52 years, Monsignor. Wow. So, I mean, actually now, believe it or not, this hemisphere is now currently without a current war. So the American hemisphere has absolutely no wars going on, which is good news. And interestingly enough, this weekend, Sunday, tomorrow, they're going to be voting on this in a referendum in Colombia. And all the polls have said that it is likely to pass. So we're actually going to see some peace hopefully come to that country. Maybe some of those folks can go home.
Well, you know, Tom, that's a good lead into what I kind of want to end our show with today. That agreement there is not without controversy. And I say it's not without controversy because obviously FARC, the drug lords, have been doing stuff that's awful, violent, whatever, and it's just an awful, awful situation. And so the government now negotiates with them. And, you know, we always hear on the movies, we hear on television, we hear on press releases, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. So, you know, I'm just telling you what people say. This is a case where there was negotiation with criminals. And so, and there was some compromises made in which, you know, that group was given some money, they were given access to things and things of that nature. So it's a very interesting situation in which you kind of like try to figure out what the best thing to do is in a situation. And in light of that, I know I have been very, very cynical about this presidential election and politics in the country. So I want to say something very, very positive. I watched the entire presidential debate, as did probably close to 100 million people. And I've been picking on the fact as a nation, we don't vote, we don't do things, we're kind of complacent. But this was a real indication that people are paying attention to what's going on. I think there were like 84 million who watched it on television, and then maybe another 15 million or so listened on radio and streaming and all of those types. So 100 million people, not bad, not bad that many people were watching it. So that's one positive thing. The debate itself, which I watched, I felt very, very positive about the debate. And let me say this. I think the moderator, which they always criticize the moderator and they always say, well, how's the moderator doing? Moderator, in my money, did great job. Great job because for the most part, he got out of the way. Sure, some people criticize, but you're getting my read on this. Stayed out of the way so that for the hour and a half, we basically got to see the two presidential candidates being able to speak about their issues, what they wanted to communicate. And again, from my perspective, well, I thought it was real positive. I think you got to see what both candidates were about. You got to see them. They presented themselves, I think, in the way that they wanted to present themselves, good points, bad points, whatever. So I think the American people were the winners when it came to this because, you know, they got a clear view of the Republican candidate. They got a clear view of the Democratic candidate. And that's what the debate is supposed to be. And it was done in a way which wasn't sound bites. It wasn't like ads. It wasn't all one side. Now, that's not to say that people didn't use pet phrases and didn't use that. But we the viewers, the listeners, can judge whether we like those pet phrases. So I'm up. I'm up on the fact that so many Americans viewed the debate. I'm up on that we had a moderator who kind of got the ball rolling and for the most part stayed out of it so that we could see the candidates themselves. And I'm there because I'm positive because, at least from my point of view, I got to see those candidates in front of me and I got to listen to their own words, their own actions, their own approaches without it being spun and filtered. So I'm up for the debate. I thought it was good. I think it's a good step forward for this presidential season. So, you know, we talked about this week, people on the move. We talked about refugees. We talked about immigrants. And we talked about, you know, people, mass incarceration, all issues which are critical to our country and critical to us on Just Love if we want to make our country more just and more compassionate, if we want to make our world more just and more compassionate. And so it is an important time. There are critical issues that we face, and we need to bring our Catholic values to the public square to push our world more towards justice and more towards compassion. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.